Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 5th of May. This hour of the program, we're going to be talking about offshore oil drilling, and we'll also be talking about tapping the nation's emergency oil stockpile to relieve pump prices that have stayed around $4 a gallon. Although today I noticed they were a little less than $4 a gallon. Our guest has written an interesting piece that appears in the Mercury News, and you can read it if you go to mercurynews.com. He's a professor of economics at Stanford University, specializing in the energy sector, is chair of the California Independent System Operators Market Surveillance Committee, which is an independent monitor for the electricity supply industry. And he wrote an article about both the topics that I mentioned at the top of the hour. He's a professor of economics, and his name is Professor Frank Wolek. We'll look at Senator Barack Obama's reversing his position on energy sufficiency, where he talked about limited new offshore drilling. And he also talked about tapping the nation's emergency oil stockpile. And we ask what you think is the solution to, at least short-term solution to, very high prices, and what the long-term solution may be. Our guest says that strong world demand, really, and not the actions of speculators, is responsible for the high price of oil. But we also heard on the news that the price is going down. So what's going on is the question of the hour. Our phone number, as always, is 1-800-486-8655, 1-800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee today, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050 for you to join our conversation. Professor Frank Wolek, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Let's talk about this idea of going into the reserves. You have written that releasing a small amount of oil from the U.S. reserve may still make sense. Why do you think that?
Well, just because it's sort of a good time to sell oil. It seems very hard to believe that the price of oil could stay up this high for a sustained period of time. There's so many sort of perfect storm factors that are leading to it, at these levels. So if only just because of the fact that the U.S. needs money, and now's a good time to sell. But in terms of really impacting the world oil price by doing this, at least the magnitudes being talked about by Speaker Pelosi and Barack Obama, is very hard to make any sense of.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about that perfect storm. What are the conditions causing the prices to be, even though they're going down a bit today and yesterday, so high?
Well, a big part of it is unfortunately the rest of the world is figuring out that the American way of life is pretty nice, and in particular the sorts of things that we do of very fossil fuel and oil intensity. I mean, just to take an example, despite the tremendous increase in oil, price of oil over the past, say, 10 years, from 2001 to 2008, demand in China increased at roughly an annual rate of between, 6 to 8% per year. And there's lots of people in China, as well as, and then demand in India, same sort of thing. So a lot of it is that demand in the developed countries, industrialized countries, is slowing down for the reasons that we know of. But unfortunately, it's an integrated world market, and the demand outside the U.S. is very strong.
Mm-hmm. It is slowing down significantly in this country?
I mean, the U.S. is probably, if any, to take the comparable figure for the U.S., it probably grew over that same time period, perhaps, not at all. It sort of held steady in terms of U.S. demand, and over the past year, it's probably fallen. In the fact that because prices have risen so much for gasoline and other products that use oil, demand is probably, if anything, held steady, if not fallen. Those are sort of the best numbers I've seen.
So what are we doing? We're not driving SUVs. We're riding our bikes. We're not heating our houses. What are we doing?
That's all of the above, I would guess, to different extents. I mean, it's difficult to know exactly, but as someone who lives in the Bay Area in California, I can say the freeways around the Bay Area are certainly less crowded. So that's a nice thing.
Yeah, that is a nice thing. No, so that definitely. Tell me a little bit more. I don't understand. about the U.S. reserve. When did we get a reserve? How much oil do we have in that reserve? And when have we tapped into it?
Very rarely have we tapped into it, but a few numbers I think help to put it in perspective. The world oil market is roughly about 85 million barrels a day is consumed. The U.S. consumes, say, on the order of about 22 million barrels of those a day. And the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is roughly, at the present time, about 770 barrels of oil. And so think of it, that's the stock of oil that we have in the reserve. It's typically held to, you know, ensure against so-called supply interruptions. The problem there is that, you know, it is a very highly integrated world oil market, so the sorts of, quote, supply interruptions are, you know, quite unlikely to occur, even though it is true that certain countries have difficulty providing oil at certain times. But there's a sufficient amount of inventory in the system to absorb that, just like you'd expect any company, you know, that produces product to keep inventory on site. There's a considerable amount of inventory that's kept on site and just in the pipelines, everything else, in tankers, in rail cars, et cetera. You know, just to put that in perspective, the estimate of that magnitude of the amount, if you like, of commercial inventories, good numbers on that say it's on the order of about 7 billion barrels. So, it's more than 10 times more than the U.S., if you like, Strategic Petroleum Reserve.
Mm-hmm. So if we tapped into that, where would all that oil go?
It most likely probably into the inventories of other countries.
Really?
And into the process. I mean, just to take an example, you know, if tapping into the strategic oil inventory of the level that, say, is being contemplated by Speaker Pelosi or Barack Obama, that's, say, about, you know, 70 million barrels is what they're contemplating releasing. But to put that in context, that would say that's roughly about 1/400th or between 1/400th and 1/450th of the annual consumption of oil in the world, i.e. trivial. So,
right.
You know, if anything, it would just sort of, you know, think of it as, you know, everyone announcing that this is going to happen, and then people would just say, I'll run down my inventories a little bit more for the day that they plan to release it, and then just buy up those inventories when they do release it, and the U.S. has just, you know, sold me oil that I probably would get a little cheaper, you know, marginally cheaper, if not no cheaper, than I would have gotten otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just not a large enough magnitude to be able to, you know, impact the price when you think of it as this is a market where the product can be stored. There's a considerable amount of storage within the system.
So the price of gas wouldn't go down?
I don't even think, you know, I think it would be the sort of thing of, like, you wouldn't even notice it. It'd be hard to tell that you even released it looking at the data.
So why do it?
The only reason to do it, as I say, is if you think that, you know, which I tend to think is probably true, is that, you know, these are pretty high prices right now. Given that there's, you know, what we see on the horizon for the economy, world demand for oil, at least from, you know, industrialized countries, probably is going to fall further, not for reasons we like, i.e. recessions and downturns, things like that. So now may be a good time for the government to sell some of what it has in the reserve for, you know, the purposes of raising revenue.
Mm-hmm. Is it also being done for political reasons?
Oh, I mean, I think this is, you know, trying to, you know, as P.T. Barnum said, no one ever got poor underestimating the intelligence of the average American. So maybe that's it.
Maybe
which
that
is unfortunate. And I will quickly say, as an economist who teaches economics, I accept part of the blame of being, you know, unable to teach people these sorts of things, but that's why I'm talking to you.
That's right. And that's why you keep teaching, right?
It's yes.
Important. It's interesting to me that the American people, according to percentages I've seen, 70% say do this now. And I think it's because of the belief that their gas prices are going to go down somewhat significantly. So they're being sold a bill of goods, right? Isn't that what's making them in favor of this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're always looking for the easy solutions, and unfortunately, mm-hmm. this is a problem that really doesn't have an easy solution. I, you know, just to, We are, significant importers of oil. I don't think that's a terrible thing per se. And we operate in a world oil market. That's sort of just as the same thing as that we operate in a world oil market for bananas or for coffee. Mm-hmm. And we import virtually all of what we consume of that as well. And as someone who needs coffee every morning, that I view that as a strategic product too. Mm-hmm. But there are certainly things that can be done, and many of them, in fact, fairly soon. It's just that they tend to not be, what might be politically favored, I guess.
Right.
Would be the best way to characterize it.
Don't you think it's amazing to see what's happened in China on the streets of Beijing as a result of taking so many cars off the road for the Olympics? It's just, the sky is blue.
Well, yeah, that's I guess one of the benefits of being able to do that. it certainly is temporary, unfortunately. We could think of that's the analog of probably, putting a little bit more of the strategic petroleum on the market too, and we've seen no change in world oil prices as a result of that.
Right. What do they mean when they talk about selling that oil, which is highly refined, and then putting a lot of this stuff that's a junkier quality back into the reserves? What's that all about?
Oil is, although a homogeneous, relatively homogeneous product, there are different types of, is sort of a second order issue. You continually have to some extent turn over the oil. There is oil that goes in, and there's oil that's coming out. It's not that, you are going to say, I'll just stick it in the ground and that's it. There's continually sort of stuff that is being purchased and stuff that's being taken out.
Mm-hmm. The other change of position from Senator Barack Obama concerned limited new offshore drilling. Can we talk about how much oil might be there? Do we have any idea how much oil might be there? Again, a reversal of position from him. Senator McCain is advocating more oil drilling off the U.S. coast as well, even though Congress has had a ban on this for a long period of time. Is there a lot of oil there?
Well, interestingly enough, I think, the most truthful answer I can give is I think no one really knows, but I guess the other answer would be obviously, not enough to really probably bail us out, I think, is the other answer in terms of, it's not like we're all of us, it could be, but no one really knows exactly what's out there. But one would have expected that, at least with the technology that existed, say, 30, 40 years ago before those bans existed, no one thought that there was a whole lot at the places and so did not explore there. But, the other thing that has changed is the technology for exploration has improved substantially, and the ability, a good example is Brazil is extremely good at drilling in very, very deep water, and that's a technology that's been developed, say, in the past 10 to 20 years. So that's where I would say the uncertainty exists, is certainly probably with the technology that existed 40 years ago, no one thought there was a whole lot that was there. But, the technology has changed considerably in the intervening years.
Yeah. Do you worry about damage to the environment?
Oh, yes. But I think that's the other thing that is important to bear in mind is, the beauty of engineering is that you can achieve almost any level of environmental sort of protection in the process of exploration. There's only one problem with that, is that it significantly increases the cost. So the way I view it is that it really is how much do I want to pay for the quality of the risk say a oil spill or something like that I want to mitigate, rather than just simply saying, I'm not going to do it. But I view that as sort of that's my personal judgment. But I think it's important to recognize that there is this, you can achieve almost any level of safety you want. It's just going to increase the cost. And if we think that's justifiable, I certainly am happy to pay the cost.
Mm-hmm. We welcome phone calls. We have a ton of people who want to speak to you on this issue, and we'll take them momentarily. Our guest is Professor Frank Wulick. He is a professor of economics at Stanford University, specializing in the energy sector, chair of the California Independent System Operators Market Surveillance Committee, which is an independent monitor for the electricity supply industry, and he wrote a recent article in the Mercury News, and we're welcoming phone calls about offshore drilling and also tapping the oil reserves, the price of oil, why it's gone down a little bit lately, why it went up so high, and all of that. So join us. 800-486-8655 is the number. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now at 800-486-8655 or 414-227-2050 in Milwaukee. Doug from Colfax, our first caller. Hi, Doug.
Hello, Kathleen. Thanks for the program.
Sure.
I've read several articles in recent months by economists and on the BBC International website that say the fundamentals only support a price for a barrel of oil at about $60 to $80. So my question is not why is oil dropping the last few days, but why has it stayed so high for so long?
Well, I guess the first issue I'd say is it's important to kind of bear in mind there are a number of factors that I think are kind of pushing things up. The first is, well, not pushing things up, but I think help to explain it is first is the price of oil is typically traded in U.S. dollars. The U.S. dollar has certainly been increasingly weak over the past, say, few years, in particular, just to give a comparison, roughly in, say, 2003, the dollar and euro were trading at parity. Now it's about $1.6 per euro, so that's going to explain a large part of why the U.S. dollar price of oil is so much higher. The other is simply the role of the what I'll call national oil company. I think this is something that is not appreciated as well as it should be appreciated, is that roughly 80% of the world's reserves are controlled by national oil companies, meaning companies that own the oil, that own the oil rather than, the Exxons, the shareholder companies. And one of the nice things about shareholder companies is that they do, have desire, or at least the incentive system is designed for them to maximize, if you like, the discounted present value of the asset that they own, whereas the national oil companies, best example, a caricature of this would be Venezuela and Hugo Chavez. For him, he just wants to make sure he gets the sufficient amount of revenue to accomplish what he'd like to accomplish, and that can occur either by a very high price or by, increasing supply. But increasing supply is going to cost money to, build the oil wells and things like that. So part of the problem there is just that, I think people are recognizing, wow, with 80% of the world's reserves in the hands of folks like this, where are we going to, build for the future? And that's going to then say people are thinking, well, we better, conserve now. And I think that's another factor that's pushing up the price.
Anything more, Doug?
No, that's a terrific answer. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks so much for your call. Let's go next to Larry from Whitehall. Hi, Larry.
Hello, and thanks. My question is this. I have a friend whose brother works at a huge oil consultancy in Amsterdam. This organization tracks the flow of oil all around the world. He told me 5 or 6 years ago that at the end of World War II, the United States and Japan, part of the surrender terms were that Japan would buy oil only from the United States for 200 years, and also something similar in Germany for a shorter period. And, of course, that was back when the supply of oil seemed vast and unlimited. I always wondered if there was any truth to this. And I Googled World War II surrender terms, and I really couldn't find anything. But someone else said, yes, there was something to it. Seems like it would have a huge influence on oil today. Can your guest verify or put the lie to this?
Unfortunately, I'm just a lowly economist, not a World War II historian, but I guess I would offer the following comment, is that it's really important to remember that this is a integrated world market where effectively it's impossible for me to, like, color my barrels, so to speak, of, you know, that the U.S. barrels are, you know, red, white, and blue, and say, you know, Saudi Arabian barrels or some other color, and those are the only barrels that I'm, you know, I'm willing to buy. I mean, it all gets dumped in a big tanker. It then could get dumped in another, you know, tanker and moved to another place. So that, you know, whose oil and who we're buying oil from really, if you like, becomes mostly a shell game and impossible really to trace. The simplest way to think about it, as long as some oil shows up at the place that it needs to be refined, that's really all we care about, and that's really all that the market trades. So, but it is true that we could keep this fiction up that, you know, I'm only sending the checks to this country, but where this country is actually getting the oil that they are, in fact, selling to me is really very, very difficult for us to figure out. So the short answer to your question would be is, we could probably still be sustaining that relationship of they only buy from the U.S., but the thing is, where the U.S. is getting the oil that it sells to these countries is anyone's guess.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts, Professor Wallach, about whether or not the United States can end its reliance on oil from the Middle East and Venezuela over the next 10 years by investing in green energy? Is that just a pipe dream, or could it happen?
I think your statement's correct, so therefore I didn't have to say that, but yes, I mean, the contribution of renewable resources is, you know, very small and, you know, likely to stay there for quite some time. I mean, just the enormous scale that would be necessary to invest, to just give an idea of what would be involved. Domestic oil production is 5 to 6 million barrels per day. U.S. oil consumption is 22 million. That's just a huge gap that we would have to overcome. And once again, I certainly don't think that the fact that the U.S. Is import dependent is necessarily a bad thing. You know, I agree from the perspective of the political side, but that just strikes me as we need to exercise some restraint on that. But, there are many products where we purchase the vast majority of those products in international markets, and, you know, very little of it is produced in the U.S. I just think that the oil in that sense is really, you know, nothing unusual. And I guess the good news there is that, you know, fewer countries are really able to, exert as much influence over price, because more and more supply and more substitutes are becoming available.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Ron from Sparta next. Hi, Ron.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. A friend of mine sent me this a couple weeks ago. It's called the Bakken, B-A-K-K-E-N formation. The study of this was done by the U.S. Geological Service in 2008, and only the scientists and oil men knew it was coming. The reserve is in North Dakota, South Dakota, and Montana, 503 billion barrels estimated. At $107 a barrel, it would bring in $5.3 trillion. This has been shown to legislators. I think we're being hung by the oil companies and our own government. This can be extracted for $16 a barrel. And if you read the information, Google it on Internet, B-A-K-K-E-N formation, you will find out that there is so much oil out west going to the refineries, there is no room for this oil in the pipeline. That's why they're not drilling it.
What do you think, Professor Wallach?
Well, there certainly is true that there is the infrastructure. I think you raise a good point about the infrastructure in terms of pipeline capacity and other sorts of things. And the other point that I would take that you raise is that there are many, many sort of what I guess I would call of near oils out there that are certainly economic at current world oil prices. And your guest, your caller just named one. That's I think also responding to the other caller's point about based on fundamentals, the price is very, very high. I think that's really also relevant to his question in that, that's why it just seems very hard to believe that these prices can stay at this level for this long. Now I just want to say one reason why they could, and that is uncertainty in U.S. carbon policy, in that one of the big things that is sort of stopping a lot of these kinds of developments is the fact that people don't know the price of carbon. So, you're an investor, you're thinking of sinking the large dollars into such a one of these projects that will do, say, coal to liquids or near oils to liquids or whatever to produce it. And you run the numbers and you go, wow, at current prices of $100 a barrel, I could do fantastic. And then, but you say, whoops, but wait a minute, suppose that the U.S. really gets serious about carbon and the carbon tax is, say, $200 per ton of CO2, that just ruined the economics of my project. And so, in many ways, the uncertainty that exists in the U.S. with respect to, the future carbon policy is really, I think, putting the kibosh on people's willingness to invest. And so the sooner, the U.S. decides, okay, we don't believe in this, global warming bunk, that one view, or we really do believe, and here is this price that we think is going to be the price of carbon. I think that will help to get these sorts of projects online. But it's that uncertainty that no one knows that's, I think, really leaving us in this place where if you look out there, you see all these sources that are economic at current prices that aren't being developed.
Thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Habu from Green Bay. Hi.
No, I'm from Madison. But anyway, referring to the your guests implying that there's world demand out there. There is always world demand out there, but it certainly hasn't gone up so dramatically in 1 year that would cause prices to double, if not triple, or quintuple, as it has been. I mean, this game of implicitly blaming China or India is completely fatuous. India, China have been growing very rapidly for the last 5-10 years, yet the prices were kind of going along until until the war began, meaning the United States occupation of Iraq, and then the threats to Iran, and as long as those threats, like all options are on the table, continue, speculators are taking advantage of that and bidding up the price of oil. And just one other point, even people, eminent people in the business, like George Soros, the financier, has said that if there is a legislation brought by Congress against or to regulate commodity index markets, then only will the price of oil come down. And Michael Masters, a hedge fund manager, testified before Congress that if such legislation came down, gasoline price would be $2 a gallon. And that is why prices are not coming down. Even if we release oil from the strategic reserve, because it is a kind of a manufactured scenario, not a real one reflecting supply and demand. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Professor Woolock.
Yeah, I would just like to say I'm certainly not blaming India or China for the rise in oil. I'm simply saying that demand in those countries has been extremely strong over the last 10 years. If we're going to blame anybody, I guess I'd blame the U.S. We're certainly, relative to our population in the world, we certainly, the only one that beats us in per capita oil consumption is Saudi Arabia. Mm. To comparison, U.S. per capita consumption is roughly about, just to take the case of India, It's probably, it's 25 times, more than 25 times that of India, and, more than to 12 times that of China. So clearly we're to blame if anyone's to blame, but I don't think blame is a useful thing to do. But in terms of supply and demand, I the only point that I would make there is that at current prices, world consumption is in fact slightly higher than world production. And in fact, if anything, we're pulling stuff out of the inventories in the system. So, on that basis, it certainly, from at least the way that I would think about it is that we're consuming everything that's being produced plus a little bit more out of inventories. So it's really hard to see how, speculators are impacting that price, given that if anything, we're consuming more than we're producing and willing to pay for it at that world price.
Mm-hmm. Let me mention part of, I'm sure you saw this, the New York Times editorial yesterday on Energy Follies, in which it talked about speculators reviled by the Democrats. Most economists, yourself included, believe they have little or nothing to do with oil prices. But I think the meat of what they were saying here, and we've been talking about this for years and years and years and years, is that the nation has been diverted from what they call the intellectually rigorous debate over energy policy that it needs to have and should have in an election year, while sparing the Senate from developing serious policies that could help set the country on a more energy efficient and environmentally sound course. Why doesn't that happen? Why do we talk about this for 30 years, 40 years?
Well, it's easier. I guess it's often easier to blame than to solve problems. But on the issue of speculators, I think the important thing, other important thing to bear in mind is it's sort of, as Pogo said, what is it? We have met the enemy and he is us, in the sense that, many of the people are sitting at home trading things on their desk. But the important thing to remember about speculators is they buy things they don't intend to consume and they sell things they don't produce. And in particular, what that says is that they're just... what they're trying to do is effectively what economists like to call, price discovery. So in that sense, they're not really holding a net position in the actual product. They're just simply saying, helping, if you like, to smooth price stages to be more reflective of where the product price is going to go. So I'll take part of the hit on that as an economist, is a failure on the part of the economics profession to explain adequately, what the role of speculation is. But, the simplest way to describe it would be is in economics classes that people have taken, we'll draw that nice little graph with the upward sloping supply curve, the downward sloping demand curve, and then we tell you that price figures out how to be at the intersection of those two curves. Well, part of the way that price gets to that location at every point in time is through the actions of speculators who are trying to essentially, find that, if you like, that equilibrium price. Unfortunately, they are profiting from the fact that they figured out sooner than others where it is, took, therefore, the position that said, gee, I think right now the price is a little bit below that, and so buy and then sell at the higher price later. But, think of it, the more speculators there are, the quicker that's going
to
happen.
Right. Habu, thanks for your call. Let's go to Tom from La Crosse next. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, I was just wondering, back, as far back now as 4 years, probably 3.5, 4 years ago, the price of diesel was always notoriously cheaper than gasoline. And I know they did go to the low sulfur diesel, but I myself switched to diesel for work purposes because gasoline was costing too much. And then all of a sudden we get price increases and diesel is like 30% higher than gasoline. And I'm just wondering what has changed. Is it just supply and demand that we're not refining enough of it? Because it also affects households when it comes to fuel oil also. So I guess I can take my answer off the air.
Okay, Tom. Thanks.
Yeah, that's a great question, and in particular, sort of, we're now getting to the sort of the energy techie portion of the show, but effectively, the simplest way to think about that is that refineries produce products, you know, from crude oil in different sorts of mixes, and you know, there is flexibility in the refining process, and oftentimes the simplest way would be to describe it would be is there are, you know, different products become constraints in the refining process, and as a result of those different products becoming constraints, the price of that product has to rise. So, for example, suppose that we're pushing as much oil through the system as we can, but we can't produce enough gasoline, but we got plenty of diesel that's going through the process as a result. So therefore, we can set the price of diesel lower to get rid of that diesel, and therefore have to, in some sense, price more to restrict the demand on the price of gasoline. So that could be what the callers initially, the circumstances that existed. Now people have done what, you know, more people are switching to diesel, and so the demand for diesel went up. So anybody that could switch to exploit that sort of difference. And now we're in a different situation where it's probably a lot of gasoline, and the constraint in the refining process is the diesel, and that's, in some sense, what's pushing it. So, you know, it is, and the other, just to follow on that further, is the refining capacity in the U.S., you know, the best fact I could give on that is we have not built a new refinery since the 1970s. Now, true, we've increased refining capacity, but there has not been a greenfield refinery built in that amount of, in that, since that time period. And so what this means is that we're sort of, you know, operating very much on a knife edge in these sorts of things, so these sorts of problems can arise and persist for some time. You know, to the extent that, you know, greater refining capacity could be sited and built, these sorts of problems would not be as likely to arise.
More phone calls in just one moment. We're talking about oil. We're looking at changes in position in the term on the part of Senator Barack Obama, and looking at his energy speech yesterday in which he endorsed limited new offshore drilling if it was not something that would hurt the environment, and also said that we should look at tapping the nation's energy oil stockpile to relieve pump prices that have stayed around $4 a gallon. Senator McCain, again, advocating more oil drilling off the U.S. coast, and says anybody who says that we can achieve energy independence without using and increasing these existing energy resources either doesn't have the experience to understand the challenge that we face or isn't giving the American people some straight talk. So we're looking at all of these issues, and they're slightly complicated, but our guest is helping us understand the economics of the whole thing, Professor Frank Wallach. He is Holbrook Working Professor of Commodity Price Studies in the Department of Economics at Stanford University. And we'll be back with you in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, you may have seen this report released yesterday by the Center for Science in the Public Interest that shows that nearly every possible combination of the children's meals at KFC, Taco Bell, Sonic, Jack in the Box, and other chains is too high in calories. They released the results of an investigation into the nutritional quality of kids' meals at 13 top restaurant chains, and they found that 93% of 1,474 possible choices at the 13 chains exceed 430 calories, which is one-third of what the Institute of Medicine recommends that children age 4 through 8 should consume in a day. So we'll talk about that and what the recommendations are to allow parents and children to know how many calories and what kind of fat and sodium is in the fast food that they are eating. Back to phone calls now as we look at oil, and we go next to Jan from Madison. Hi, Jan.
Oh, no, this is Ann.
Oh, it's Ann. Hi, Ann.
Sorry. This is, if there was ever a conspiracy, I think we've got one now. We're being jerked around, as your guest pretty much admitted, by speculators. Some of these guys are billionaires, and the hedge fund managers are finding out how much the dumb American is willing to pay for gas, and then, you know, setting the prices pretty much accordingly. And until we start thinking for ourselves, this is going to continue. It's too bad that Obama now has advisors who are corporate and who are giving him the same kind of corporate-oriented advice they gave to Kerry and to Gore. And as a result, people people may just stay home and not vote for him because they don't perceive we have a choice. I mean, what's going on is this was all part of the secret energy plan produced in 2001 by Cheney and oil company executives and, you know, car company executives, presumably. And we're going to either invade Iran if we can. If we can't do that, we'll start offshore drilling. We'll start drilling in pristine northern territory. And the ultimate result, I think, will be that the oil companies will have a monopoly. They're not using their millions of acres of drillable land right now. They want it all. And when they've got it all, then they can charge anything they want. And notice, we haven't heard much about invading Iran since Bush started saying oil prices are so high that we now have to start drilling in Anwar and doing offshore drilling, which will totally destroy tourism wherever it's done, and I've seen that happen. So, you know, we've got a real mess here with corporations ruling the world, and until Americans stand up to it and start thinking for themselves, this kind of, these lies and, you know, there's nothing complicated about these oil prices. They're being set by real human beings. They're not going up and down by themselves. And I think your guest was, you know, he was pretty realistic when he talked about the role of basically hedge fund managers who speak for the oil companies.
Professor Wallach.
Yeah, I mean, the unfortunate thing is the world consumes 85 million barrels of oil per day and is willing to consume it at the current world oil price, and that adds up to, you know, a significant amount of oil that has to arrive where people need to consume it. And so unless we figure out a way to reduce our consumption significantly, and the U.S., as we discussed, is the major center on that. We've got to pay what the people are willing to supply it at, or consume less. And that's sort of unfortunate side of the economics of the world oil market. To the extent that we can reduce our demand, find alternative sources. One area that I think is, but the unfortunate thing is we're living in a world of increasing scarcity just because there's many, many more people chasing pretty much the same amount of resources. So everything certainly has its cost. Things like, you know, nuclear power, you know, renewable energy certainly has cost as well. You've got to build the facilities. And then finally, one that I think holds some promise would be, you know, ethanol from hopefully things that we don't, you know, like to eat. So things right. like cellulosic ethanol are certainly things that, you know, need to be considered. And so currently, just to take one such policy that certainly has some peculiar incentives for the United States is the import tariff on ethanol from Brazil. And Brazil is a major producer of ethanol from corn and from sugar, and does so in a manner that really has limited impacts on the world price of sugar, just because they're able to produce it so efficiently relative to the rest of the world. So, you know, that right there is something that could, you know, tomorrow help out quite a bit in the U.S., increasing the supply of substitutes for gasoline that doesn't occur, I think, largely for reasons that most everybody can speculate on.
Yeah. Here's an email from John from Milwaukee. What is the average cost of the oil in the reserve, and would this help the budget deficit if we release this oil?
Yeah, certainly most of what was purchased in the reserve was purchased at significantly lower prices than we are seeing right now. So in that sense, that you'd be selling it at a significantly higher price than it was purchased at. Although it is true that the government has been adding to the reserve, but you know, certainly the vast majority was accumulated during a period in which the world price was significantly lower.
Mm-hmm. All right, Ann, thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Tom from Mazamani. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi.
I haven't heard this on the radio yet, and I just wanted to let the public know that in early May, when they first sent out the first stimulus check, that the prices here in the Madison area were at like $3.11 a gallon. And 3 weeks ago when they sent the last stimulus check out, since then the gas prices dropped 40 cents a gallon. So I just wanted to make a comment that it's funny how this worked out.
You see a connection there, Professor Wallach?
Well, I think that certainly you can't rule it out, but I think the unfortunate thing is another aspect of it is just the increasingly not very good news about the economy is certainly in the U.S. is certainly helping to reduce the demand for gasoline. But I think the caller raises a nice point in that certainly stimulus package is increasing consumption. Probably the first place you're going to stick that stimulus package is in, the gasoline that you might be willing to buy.
Right. Thanks so much, Tom, for your call. Let's go to Richard from Elkmont. Hi, Richard.
Good morning. Thank you so much for the wonderful program. A couple of questions and I guess a comment. I know we're going to have to eventually switch to other forms of energy or at least have greater competition, and I look forward to the day when trees can produce ethanol. But if we do find more oil or we produce more oil, one of my concerns is that more oil doesn't necessarily mean cheaper oil. If more oil is harder to get, my question really relates to an assumption that the cost of production is going to be higher and it's going to keep that per barrel price up as world demand remains high. So I'm concerned, one, about the cost of production, and would like a response to that. The second issue is, could we keep the price of oil lower by smarter use of the technology we have or improve technology in order to get more BTUs that are functional out of the oil that we are now using? And a third focus is shifting the way we use our carbon-based fuels. It's my understanding, for example, that Argentina has a compressed natural gas vehicle that runs throughout the country. You can just walk into it or pull into a station and fill up with compressed natural gas. So where we're using natural gas to run power plants and homes, we are using very little for automobiles, and we're using almost exclusively oil for either diesel or gasoline. So my questions relate to, I guess, perhaps smarter uses through technology, redistribution, and then this question of more oil doesn't necessarily mean cheaper oil because of what it's going to take to get it.
Wow, I thank the caller for his questions. I want him in my class. Those are great questions. I think the point about harder to get oil being more costly, I think, is spot on in the sense that, going back to the point that one of the callers made about, the fundamentals is probably closer to a $60 to $70 barrel price of oil. I think that's really the issue, is that at the days of, say, $30 per barrel oil, it's really hard to believe how we're ever going to get there again, unless, demand just really drops off for some reasons that we probably don't like, but to see. So I think that's exactly right, that we're in a new regime of higher-priced oil. But just to emphasize that's just reflective of the fact that we are, finding the harder to get oil. On the issue of more efficient use, I think that's really where the genius of sort of the American market mechanism is going to work. Energy efficiency is, I think, a significant source of at least slowing the growth of the demand for oil. And I think that in large part explains why, if you would compare, say, China's growth rate in oil consumption versus the U.S. is that there's a lot of energy efficiency investments taking place that are now becoming economic because of the very high price of oil. And that could be a whole other program. There's really some fascinating stuff going on in terms of things that are happening. And then the other last question that the caller raised about, using natural gas and the like, is that really, I think, points to what I think is really another aspect of the energy efficiency question. But you could think of it as a nice way to think of the question is, if you take the dollar per BTU, and BTU is sort of useful energy price that the caller referred to, the dollar per BTU price of oil is traditionally significantly higher than the dollar per BTU price of, say, natural gas. So one thing that happens is this creates incentives for people to invest in technologies that allow them to get that cheaper BTU and use it in the same way that they could use the expensive BTU. So in other words, a car that could run natural gas. And those sorts of investments have been taking place. And the interesting thing that we did see up until very recently was almost a greater convergence between the dollar per BTU price of oil and the dollar per BTU price of natural gas. But more recently, with the massive increase in the world price of oil, that's changed.
Thank you so much for the hour. You were so informative.
Okay.
Appreciate it. Professor Frank Wallach, he is Holbrook Working Professor of Commodity Price Studies in the Department of Economics at Stanford University. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to John Treader for on-air production. We'll have another hour coming up following the news.